All right, guys, we are in the book of Ruth tonight. If you would turn there with me, please. Have you ever been at a place? Well, you know what? Let me read something to you guys out of Proverbs chapter 14. You've heard me say it before, and you're probably familiar with it yourself. Out of Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12, it says, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death." Have you ever made a decision and been absolutely sure it was right at the time, only later to find out it wasn't right? You know, it's amazing because this proverb about us making a decision and it's right in our own eyes, boy, we can get ourselves in a lot of trouble with that. And have you ever noticed that everyone has a slightly different take on everything, and yet they're absolutely sure that they're right? When we haven't had any in a long time, but years ago when we would have our family reunions, we would get together, and you know how family reunions go. Everybody gets together and talks about the events that took place. And my brother would talk about an event that took place, and I would remember the event, but he'd start telling about the event, and I'm going, "Were you even there?" He remembered it completely different than I remembered it. And we're talking about the same event. In some cases, it involved both of us. We knew basically the same facts. When he was telling the story, I knew what the story was, and I knew what the next thing was he was going to say, but his version of it was completely different. His opinion of it was completely different. He saw it completely different than I did. And yet, we were both at the same place at the same time, doing the same thing, and experiencing the same event. Anybody ever had that happen to you? Well, you know, one of the things that I see often, even in the ministry and being around folks, and you know, having lived a little longer than maybe some of you guys, and that is, no matter what we go through in life, we filter it through our own set of things. And we can be involved in exactly the same event with the same people, and yet when it's done, we have a completely different version of what has taken place. That's why policemen, when there's an accident, they try to get to the witnesses as soon as possible. And they try to be able to sit and talk to the witnesses and get an account of what took place. And they will tell you it's extremely difficult to get two or three corroborating stories. Because you have two or three people standing on the same street corner, they see the same accident, and yet they have a different viewpoint of exactly what took place. And yet, if you ask each one of them, they will tell you, "This is what happened. I saw it with my own eyes. This is exactly what happened." But you see, one guy's standing on the southwest corner. The next witness is standing on the southeast corner. The next one's on the northwest corner, and the next one's on the northeast corner. They all see the same accident, but they all see it from a slightly different position, slightly different angle. So their viewpoint of it is a little bit different. And yet, all of them are right in what they translate. You see that a little bit in the three Gospels. You see three Gospels that have a slightly different look at the same story. Now, what ends up happening with us in life is we also believe that what we see is the truth. We believe that what we experience is the truth. So I guess to some degree with all of those folks, they are right in exactly what they see. Well, now in life, we do the same thing. We have a tendency to believe that what we see is truth. What we experience is exactly truth. And so it's easy to understand when we look at it that way, this proverb that says that there is a way that seems right to a man, but if he's not careful, the end of it can end up in destruction, because our truth might not be truth. Our perspective might not be truth. And so it puts you and I in a position to where when we make choices, we need to be very, very careful about the choices that we make. A lot of us, and a lot of times, when we're faced with a difficult choice or a difficult decision, we make that full decision within ourselves. Or maybe we go outside of that and we consult one person that's very close to us. Or maybe we consult a third person who's very close to us. But we might find, just like the street corner, if we ask the same people who were standing on the same street corner as us, on the southeast corner or the northwest corner with us, they're going to agree with us that what we saw is 100% accurate. But there's at least three more perspectives, aren't there? There's at least three other ways to be able to look at this. Sometimes we as Christians, we will miss the most important opinion of all when we have to make decisions. Often, we will not consult the one that matters the most, and that is the Lord. Or at least we won't get outside of our circle. You know, we all have our circle. But sometimes we won't get outside of our circle, and I think as a result of that, if we're not careful, we can end up making some pretty bad choices. So tonight in the book of Ruth, you'll see that the title is a brief introduction and also entitled Choices. The book of Ruth, we're only going to get to about four or five verses tonight, but it is a beautiful story of love and faithfulness. And it is a time period when the judges ruled Israel. If you look at Ruth 1:1, it says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." This particular time was marked by immorality, it was marked by idolatry, and even a great deal of war. And you might remember from our study in the book of Judges, let me read you something out of Judges 21:25. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes." You see, sometimes we can get to a place where we go, you know what, as long as I feel that it's right, then it's okay. If I make a decision and I feel that I'm doing the right thing, then it's a good decision. But is it? Is that the right criterion by which we should base a good decision or a bad decision? The book of Ruth tells about it's a heartwarming story of devotion and faithfulness. But I think the thing that separates it or sets it apart from the ordinary, by ordinary I mean a normal or ordinary devotion and faithfulness, is that this love, this faithfulness, is between a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. Now, it's a bit more common for blood to stick together, or at least to show some devotion to each other. But I think this particular relationship between Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi, speaks of something that only God can build. You know, I believe that in the faith, the bond of Christianity that we have can allow us to have a friendship or a bond that's stronger even than blood. Now, it's great when your blood is also a Christian and you're not only able to be brother and sister or father and son or whatever the case may be because of the family ties, but if they're Christians also and you can share that with them, that's an even stronger bond. But I have heard many, 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 many people say many times when they come to church that they're closer to the church family a lot of times than they even are to their blood relatives. Well, they had a relationship that there's absolutely no doubt that God has built and put together. Ruth is a Moabite from the land of Moab, and she leaves her homeland after her husband dies to live with her Jewish mother-in-law, Naomi, in the land of Israel. Uncommon to say the least, but God directed without a doubt. God honors Ruth's commitment and devotion to her mother-in-law. You see, she had pretty much given up the idea of ever remarrying. She pretty much figured that she would be an old maid, if you will, for the rest of her life. But God seems to honor that faithfulness. God seems to honor her willingness to put him above everything else, to put love and devotion, even for her mother-in-law, above her own particular desires. And as a result of that, God leads her to a most unlikely husband that ends up just adoring her and loving her very much. Now, I want to make a little application here for those of us that might desire to be married. Maybe you're single and you desire to be married. Not all singles desire to be married, but some do. There is a tendency, not just with singleness, but a lot of problems in life, to look around, find out how we can solve it, and then go about trying to solve the problem. For a single, they can go find the largest singles group in the valley, where there's lots of activities and lots of guys to pick from and lots of gals to pick from. And they can go to the group, and they can certainly, maybe, I guess I shouldn't say certainly, but they can certainly shop, and it may be that God might supply a mate for them. But you see, I believe there's a better way. I believe that there's a higher road to take in that. And that is to dedicate yourself to God, to commit yourself to the Lord, to make all your ways known to Him and your desires known to Him, but say, God, not my will, but your will be done. And if it's your will to put someone in my path, I know that you can do that. And it doesn't have to be in a singles group of 200 people. I can be at a grocery store and bump into the person of my dreams, because that's the way that you work. And it's not just in singleness, it's in everything else in life, in a career choice, in every other place where we're trying to seek God's direction. We don't necessarily have to be able to figure it all out. We don't necessarily have to stack all the odds in our favor. The only thing we have to do is have God on our side and have the favor of the Lord and put that in God's hands and seek Him. And then God will lead us in the path that we should go. Well, she did end up, as I say, end up marrying a guy that she thought would never happen. And he does love her very much. And as a result, she finds a place in the genealogy of Christ. It has been said that this book serves at least two purposes. One, that it illustrates how God rewards those who make spiritual choices and show a steadfast loyalty to their family. And also to explain how Ruth, a Moabitess, not a Jew at all, came to be an ancestor of David and ultimately the Messiah. The book of Ruth is short. It can be pretty much set down and read in one setting. We are more than likely going to cover at least 4 weeks of it and maybe 5 weeks, because we're not going to get very far tonight. All right, we're going to repeat verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. This is prior to the kings of Israel, the time during the judges. There is a famine in the land of Judah, and it prompted this Jewish family to move to Moab to see if they could do better until this famine passed. But we're going to see as we go into our study, there's actually some other indications here that possibly the father and maybe even the sons considered it a bad business deal, a bad business opportunity to be there, because actually there wasn't really much going on. And with this famine going on, it just didn't seem to be a very good move. But let me say this, guys. We always have to make decisions. And sometimes those decisions are prompted by an event. I'm not making enough money at work. My boss has been after me and wants me to do this. They're changing my job description. Or you go home and the wife says, hey, I'm not happy here. You're not carrying your weight here. I need you to kick in this. I need you to kick in that. Or it could be just about anything. I guess what I'm saying is, heat and pressure is a part of life, and things change on us. And sometimes we are at a place where we need to make a decision. But we need to be very, very careful how we put the facts together to be able to make that decision. Bethlehem is only about 5 miles south of Jerusalem, and as most of us know, birthplace of David and Jesus. This is where this family is from. Now, the Moabite country was down towards, it was east of the Dead Sea. So this was quite a journey. When you're talking about the traveling habits of the time, and most of it was on foot, and you were taking your whole group with you and your belongings and any livestock that you had, this was quite a trip. Now, the Moabites were descendants of Lot. You guys remember Lot, don't you? Okay, let me give you something out of Genesis chapter 19. If you would turn to Genesis chapter 19, verse 36 and 37. You remember Abraham and Lot, and he basically told Lot, pick which one you want, pick which land you want, and I'll take the other one. And Lot took the best of the land and left the worst of the land for Abraham, but God still blessed Abraham. Even another example of putting your faith and trust in God and not into the circumstances. And then Lot ended up in Sodom and Gomorrah. If you look at Genesis 19:36 and 37, it says, "And thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day." Now, a sick story, yes, but Lot's daughters weren't married and they were afraid that they were never going to have children. So basically, they get their father drunk and become pregnant by him. If you factor in Lot's time in Sodom and Gomorrah, it might help to explain the distorted viewpoint of life that these girls had. Now, I only say that, well, let me make my next statement. In all fairness to these girls, they are the same two daughters that he offered up to the perverts to protect the angels who had come into town, into Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, I mention this to say this. We don't live in a perfect world. Not too many of us were raised by perfect parents and led a perfect Christian life, and now we are continuing on in that perfect Christian life. Many of us, all of us, we live in an imperfect world where things like this occur, and they affect us. They change our perspective. They change our viewpoint. They are the screen, if you will, by which life is sifted through into our life. And it is through that screen that we make decisions. So when we begin to evaluate what our next step is, our next choice is to be, it has to come through an imperfect environment, an imperfect situation, through imperfect people. That's why there can be a way that seems right to me, in my distorted viewpoint. This was a way that seemed right to these girls from their distorted viewpoint, but it surely wasn't right, was it? Now, you and I can say, well, that's just kind of perverted and wrong, but not to them. That's not the way they saw it. You see, everybody has a way that seems right to him. Everyone's convinced that the way they see things is the right way to be able to see them. Let's move to verse 2. The name of the man, the patriarch of the family, the father of the family, if you will, is Elimelech. And the name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Bethlehem was also known as Ephrath. In Genesis 35:19, it reads like this. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. So we're talking about another designation of the same place. Now, guys, I think it is a tendency of man to run when things get tough. When things get difficult, we often think, uh-oh, I'm in sin. When things get tough, it's very easy to think, I missed God. I did something wrong. God is mad at me. And I need to correct it. God, what do I need to do to correct it? How many times when things get really difficult, let's just take work for example. You go into work and your boss says, hey, you're not doing this and you're not doing this. You need to step it up. How many times do we go, you know what? My boss is absolutely right. I have been sloughing off and I need to pick it up and I need to be the man that I need to be. And praise the Lord, I'm going to do a better job. God, give me the strength to do it. That's just not the way we respond. Now, we might, after a little prayer and God readjusting us, but our first filter is, he's an idiot. What gives him the right to tell me what to do when he does this and this and this and this and this and this? You see, we project, we run. It's not my fault, it's the wife you gave me. It's not my fault, it's the husband you gave me. It's not my fault, it's the parents you gave me. It's not my fault, it is the boss that you gave me. Now, in all fairness to Elimelech, no doubt he was concerned for his family. And no doubt he wanted to provide for his family. And I see so many men make tragic mistakes based on that premise alone. I'm supposed to be the provider. I'm supposed to do, you know, I'm supposed to make a living. So therefore, I got to do whatever it takes for me to make a living. If that means move to Outer Mongolia, then I'm moving to Outer Mongolia to take care of my family. I would like to possibly propose that maybe it's not Outer Mongolia at all. Maybe it's Inner Mongolia. Maybe God's trying to work something in us. Maybe he's trying to change us from the inside out. Maybe the problem is really not exterior at all. Maybe it's not external. Because God, I don't think, really cares where, but he's concerned with how. He's concerned with the man or the woman. He's concerned with what's inside of the man or the woman, not necessarily the external circumstances. But the external circumstances only in as far as and in the way that it impacts the man or the woman for change. How many of us know that there are some things that are more important than money and more important than clothing and sometimes even food? There was a famine. That seemed to be the motivator. I don't think it was. It's only part of the motivator. If we're not very, very careful, we can make a decision that seems right, but in reality could be very, 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 very wrong for all the wrong reasons. Turn to Leviticus chapter 25. I want to read something to you that has a bearing upon Elimelech's decision to move. God had already spoken, and God had already said that he would take care of his people. If you look at Leviticus 25, verse 35, it reads like this. If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty amongst you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a foreigner that he may live with you. And you know, I think we could probably say not if one of your brethren becomes poor, but we could probably say whenever one of your brethren becomes poor. Anybody ever been poor? Every hand probably in here is at one time or another. You've been in that spot. Down on your luck between jobs, or you can't find jobs, or you've been in that spot. But he's telling the nation of Israel to look out for that brother. In verse 36 of Leviticus 25, it says, take no usury or interest from that brother, but fear your God that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food for a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, he and his children with him, and shall return to his own family. He shall return to the possession of his fathers, for they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. So they shall not be sold as slaves. And you shall not rule over him with rigor, but you shall fear your God. In other words, this is going to happen from time to time. But I want you to know they are my people. And I will protect my people. I want you to treat my people with respect and dignity, even though they are poor. And at the year of Jubilee, they're supposed to be set free so they can return back to the land that I gave them. And have a fresh start. Have a chance to start again. God had already said, it's going to happen, but I've made a provision to take care of you, even in the middle of it. Even when things are tough, I've made a provision to be able to take care of you. I think the decision, maybe I should say the decisions, that a Christian makes in a time of crisis determines the depth of his or her relationship with the Lord. If their relationship with the Lord is not very deep, their decision is going to be very shallow. If their relationship with the Lord is extremely deep, then the decision will also be deep. What happens next to this family Sure makes you wonder if Elimelech should have stayed in Bethlehem and simply trusted God to provide as God had already promised that he would do, instead of running. Look at verse 3. Then Elimelech, how'd you like to have that name? What's your name? Oh, my name's Elimelech. Say that four times really quick. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. So they get out there in the middle of Moab country, and then the patriarch dies. Dad's dead. He's gone. They're out there in the middle of this without him. Rabbinic tradition suggests that his death was punishment for greed or for having forsaken his homeland, according to the Expositor's Bible. Now, I don't know. Perhaps, perhaps not. But based on what happens and how it takes place, it sure makes you wonder. Look at verse 4. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. There's our star in the play. And they dwelt there for about 10 years. They lived in this land for about 10 years. A way that seems right to a man. Let me give you a couple scriptures that I think that he probably should have been aware of. Out of Deuteronomy 23:3, I'll read this to you. It says, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter into the assembly of the Lord forever." The Moabites would not help Israel when they were trying to cross, or after they crossed the Jordan, were trying to enter into the land of Canaan. In 1 Kings 11, verses 1 and 2, it says, "But King Solomon loved many foreign wives, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. For from the nations of whom God had said to the children of Israel, 'You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts from after their gods.' And Solomon clung to these in love." But guys, in all fairness to the sons, if you're going to raise your sons or daughters in a foreign country, what are the odds that they might end up marrying foreign women? Pretty high, wouldn't you say? If you live in Moab, and Moabites are 95% of the population, 98% of the population, aren't the odds pretty good that your sons are going to marry Moabite women? Well, how does that translate? If we are going to live any place outside of the will of God, it's pretty good odds your children are going to make choices outside of the will of God. If we are going to live carnal lives, if we're going to make bad decisions that put us in bad places, places that God's already told us not to be, if we're not very careful, we're just going to destine our children to make bad choices. And if they end up marrying ungodly men and ungodly women, yes, they have some responsibility there. Of course they do. But we also have some responsibility as their parents to make sure we make good decisions along the way. Look at verse 5. "Then both Mahlon," or Mahlon, "and Chilion also died." First the father dies, now the two sons die. All the men of the family now dead. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Again, rabbinic tradition suggests that this was because of leaving Judah and because of their marriages to these Moabite women. In fact, the Targum reads like this. Here's what it says. "And because they transgressed the decree of the word of the Lord and joined affinity with strange people, therefore their days were cut off." Well, I tell you, it's hard to know the mind of the Lord, isn't it? And you know, I do not think it's past the Lord. If he sees a future that's going to be really bad, I don't think it's unlike him to call someone home. You and I might think, "Oh, God would do that? Cut a person's life short?" You got to understand from his perspective, it's not the same as it is for our perspective. There's a way that seems right in our eyes, but it's wrong. For God, he would rather call that individual home to be with him and to live in peace the rest of their life than to see them go on the rest of their life living an absolutely miserable life. Takes the father and the two sons home. Now, Naomi felt the same way. She felt that this was a judgment from God. If you look at Ruth 1, verse 13, the last part of that verse, it says, "And the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." That was Naomi's heart. That's what she thought. That's how she felt. According to Baxter's commentary on these verses, and I quote, here's what he says, "Elimelech and his sons went to Moab to find bread, but instead they found graves." Do you know people that's made a decision and they were so sure that the decision was right? 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, it's a graveyard for them. They're absolutely miserable. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want to make those kind of decisions. I would much rather make the right decision on the front side of this than to just make a decision that seems right to me and then end up later having to try to somehow get out of it or make up for it or have it affect not only me, but, you know, every decision that we make affects other people. So many times today we think, well, this is just my decision. It just affects me. Yeah, if you lived on an island, maybe it would only affect you. But if you have a family, it affects your family. If you have a social life, it affects those that you come in contact with. I believe that this brief introduction and these first five verses, even by themselves, they help us to know and understand the importance of making correct choices. You see, choices come with consequences. Sometimes those consequences are good, and sometimes those consequences are bad. Elimelech and his sons made choices that at the time seemed to be good decisions. They seemed to be the right decisions. Moving to Moab seemed to be a good financial and a business decision because the economy wasn't good in Bethlehem. I've seen people make decisions, and they pack up their entire family, and they move somewhere. Now, please don't misunderstand me. In and of itself, that's not bad. It can be God's will, but you got to make sure that it's God's will. You've got to make that decision based on the right criterion by making sure that God has said, this is what I want you to do. And a lot of that includes counsel outside of just your own little group. Sometimes people make these decisions just within themselves, one or two people with no outside counsel to get other decisions on this, other input into it. And that doesn't mean that we're stupid or can't make decisions. It's just wisdom. Scripture says there's wisdom in many counselors. So it's wisdom to have other godly people that you trust give input on this. Now, I've seen people make the decision to pack up the entire family and go based on one decision and based on one factor and one factor alone, money. I'm getting a promotion. They're making me chief cook and bottle washer, and I'm going to make double the amount of money that I'm going to make here. So that's God's will. We got to go. But guys, there's other factors that are more important than the money. One of the things that I've noticed for folks that they factor in way down on the bottom of the list, sometimes not even at all, and that is their fellowship with God and with other Christians. Sometimes their home fellowship, their home church. Now, there are lots of good churches, and they exist all over the world. So I also don't want to imply that there's only one or two good churches in the world. There's lots of good fellowships. But what I have found is that often, sometimes, I hate to use the word often and sometimes in the same sentence, but I guess I just did. Since it was the bottom of the list, the factor is way down here, it's also on the bottom of the list when they get moved to the new place. And they never reconnect. They never really find home. When they're first deciding to go to the new place, they go visit a church and go, oh yeah, it's great. Well, they go and they move, and then they go to the place 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks and decide they don't like it. Well, now the other church is 100 miles away. So now they're in this place. They have no church family. They have no fellowship. They get to church rarely. And even though the intentions are good, quite often, you guys know what happens. Have you ever just missed church, stay home and watch a TV show? Or you've been sick. Let's say you've been sick and you miss a week or two. You remember how difficult it is once you get used to that pattern of getting back up again and going and doing what you know you need to do? Well, can you imagine multiplying that by feeling like you're out in the middle of nowhere and you don't know anyone and there's no accountability? What I'm saying is that it seemed like it was a good business financial decision because the economy wasn't good in Bethlehem. And that in and of itself might be one of the factors, but that's not the most important factor. The second thing was, it seemed like it was a good moral decision because no one could fault Elimelech for wanting to take care of his family, right? I mean, we all know as Christians what the priorities are, right? Although sometimes Christians get the second and third one really messed up. God first, family second, church third, my service to God third. Sometimes people say, hey, God comes first, my family's just going to have to suffer for it. Wrong priority. You can still have God first in your life and let somebody else do the serving if it's going to crash your family. Right? You got to keep God first, your family second, your service to God after that. Okay, so let's take those premises and we go, okay, that's it, that's good. Well, now, what I have seen some men do is because of the family, they use the family as an excuse to not be in fellowship with God. You see, it's like a two-cylinder engine. You've got to have intake and exhaust. You cannot keep your family together without your relationship with Jesus being right. So yes, the family is important, but if you don't keep the relationship with Jesus correct, the family's going to fall apart anyway. So you have to make sure that that individual relationship with Jesus is good and stays good in order to be able to be a good provider for your family. And how many of you know being a good provider for your family is not based on the amount of money you take in a month? We all want to do better. We all want to have more. We all want to be better providers for our family. We all want our children to have more than we had. By the way, I'm not so sure that's a good philosophy. I'm really not. I think a little poverty can go a long way in a child's life. So giving them everything that they want is not necessarily the answer. But we're parents. That's what we do, right? We want to be able to give our children more than we had. But if we forsake the spiritual, I think we're giving up the greater for the lesser. Now, even if Elimelech had heard of these few obscure scriptures already written about the Lord providing, it still seemed to be a good decision because of the first two things. Right? Famine in the land, need to provide for my family. Good business decision, good moral decision. Yeah, I know there's a couple scriptures that says, you know, not to mix with the Moabite women, and I know there's a few scriptures that says God will take care of us no matter what, but I'm sure God understands. There's a famine. It's time to go. How many times, guys, do we know that there are certain scriptures that speak against what we're getting ready to do, but we just somehow kind of shut them off and turn them down? So, was Elimelech's choice to move to Moab right or wrong? I think sometimes the choice is not between right or wrong, but good and better. Let me say that again. I think sometimes the choice is not necessarily right or wrong, but what's good and what's better. There's a way that seems right to a man. That seems like a good choice. But obviously that scripture means that there's a better choice, even though it seems right to me. Let me read that to you again. Proverbs 14, verses 12, and I'm going to read through to verse 16. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end is the way of death. listen to these. These are kind of neat. These hit me in a different way tonight than today when I was studying than I've ever read them before. It says, even in laughter the heart may sorrow, and the end of mirth may be grief. I'm so excited about moving. I'm so excited about changing jobs. I'm so excited about changing wives. I'm so excited about changing cars. I'm so excited about this new thing. I'm just so excited. The mirth might be there. The momentary happiness might be there. The momentary excitement with the new change might be there. It might last a year, it might last two, it might last five, it might last even eight. But there is an indication here that the end of it, if it's not the right decision, that the end of it is eventually going to bring grief. Let me go on with Proverbs chapter 14, verse 14. It says, the backslider in his heart will be filled with his own ways. The backslider in his heart will be filled with his own ways. Now, what does that mean? That means that if my relationship with God is not right, I'm going to be filled with what I want, what I see, what satisfies me, what tickles my fancy, what looks to be good, the greener pastures. I'm going to be filled with me if my relationship with God is not right on the money. In other words, that way that seems right to me is going to be much easier for me to see it as right. It says, but a good man will be satisfied from above. Now, what that means is, the man that's in the right relationship with God is going to be seeking God and saying, God, I don't want to do anything without you. I don't want to do anything without you. I don't want to turn tail and run. If you're trying to show me something, if you're trying to work something in me or through me or out of me, I want to learn this. I want to know this. I don't want to just change my circumstances. I really want to learn whatever it is that you want me to learn. Back in Proverbs 14, verse 15, the simple believes every word, but the prudent considers well his steps. Now, if the simple believes every word, that's actually a negative. That doesn't mean that he believes every word of God. He just believes what everybody's telling him. When his friends are saying, yeah, you need to do this, he's going, yeah, I need to do this. When his friends are saying, that's a good decision, he's going, oh, this is a good decision. In other words, he's not going outside of his circle to get counsel. He's just staying within his own circle, and he's believing all the words that everybody's telling him. But it says here that the prudent man considers well his steps. What if I don't find a church? What if I take this promotion and it's not good? What if the cost of this new decision is too high? What if this is just not a good thing? And verse 16 of Proverbs 14, a wise man fears and departs from evil, but a fool rages and is self-confident. That means it's possible to be foolish and just rage forward. Be absolutely confident that I'm right. But what makes me so sure I'm right? If I'm standing on one of those corners and the policeman comes and asks me for my story, what makes me so sure I'm right? Because I saw it. But wouldn't wisdom say, yes, I saw it, but I only saw it from one perspective? So I might be right from my perspective, from where I saw it. But I'll tell you what, officer, there's at least four or five more ways this can be looked at. Now, I want you to think about how that would change your relationship with your spouse if you weren't so pig-headed sure you were right. Or possibly that you were right from the way you saw it, but just maybe she was standing on another corner and sees it a little bit different, and maybe she's not wrong. Maybe you're both right. Maybe somewhere in that possibility, there's another way to look at things. Maybe when I make a decision to just run away or run to, or maybe I need to ask some other people who've been standing on the other corners and see what they think, see what they see, see what they saw. And maybe instead of so quickly writing them off, realize maybe they've got a lot of wisdom on this too. And maybe, just maybe, they can help me make a really, really, really good choices. A really good choice. And I think, guys, all the choices that we make, must be made with these words of Jesus in our mind and in our hearts at all time, out of Matthew 6:33. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. God, I just want to love you, and I don't want anything to get in the way of that. If this change is going to keep me from loving you, then I don't want it. If this move is going to keep me from loving you and staying in tight with you, I don't want it. If this purchase is going to keep me from loving you, then Lord, I don't want it. If this house is going to keep me from loving you, Lord, I don't want it. If this relationship is going to keep me from loving you, then Lord, I don't want it. Boy, I'll tell you, some decisions are really hard to make, aren't they? So let's be careful in our decision-making process, guys. Emotions and I want to's can really mess up a good godly decision. Sometimes we can be a little too flippant that we are right. But I think we can see from just these first five verses, tremendous consequence to making the wrong decisions. You got a lot of godly people that are around you. Some really good godly people that go to this fellowship. You're faced with a decision, ask them what they think. Get their opinion. Get lots of opinions.